smashed up in the afternoon, came rushing in. "Sir, the cellar of number 11 has had a direct hit, and some of the men are still buried in the ruins." As I had two cyclists and three telephonists in number 11, I took some men and hurried to their help. I found a lance corporal and a wounded man in the dugout and was given the following account. When the shells began to fall suspiciously near, four of the five occupants of the cellar decided to go down into the dugout shaft. One of them went straight away. One stayed where he was in bed, while the remaining three delayed to pull on their boots. The most prudent and the least, as so often in war, came off the best. The first had not a scratch, and the second had a splinter in the thigh. The three others were caught by the shell, which came through the cellar wall and exploded in the opposite corner. After this narration, I lit a cigar and went into the smoke-filled cellar. In the middle of it there was a heap of wreckage. Bedsteads, straw mattresses, and various pieces of furniture, all in fragments and piled nearly up to the roof. After we had put a few candles on ledges of the walls, we set to work. Catching hold of the limbs that stuck out from the wreckage, we pulled out the dead bodies. One had the head struck off, and the neck on the trunk was like a great sponge of blood. From the arm stumps of another, the broken bones projected, and the uniform was saturated by a large wound in the chest. The entrails of the third poured out from a wound in the belly. As we pulled out the last, a splintered board caught in the ghastly wound with a hideous noise. The orderly made a comment on this and was reproved by my batman with these words, "Best hold your tongue. In such matters, talking nonsense serves no purpose." I took an inventory of the valuables found on them. It was a horrible job. The candles flickered red in the vaporous air, and as the two men handed me pocketbooks and silver objects, it seemed as though we were engaged in some dark and secret work. The fine yellow plaster dust fell on the faces of the dead, and gave them the fixed look of wax figures. We threw coverings over them and hurried out of the cellar after taking up the wounded man in a ground sheet. With the stoical advice to set his teeth, we carried him through a whirl of shrapnel fire to the dressing station dugout. When I got back to my dwelling place, the first thing I did was to have a few cherry brandies. The experience I had been through had touched my nerve. Soon we were being violently shelled once more, and with the example before our eyes of what artillery fire can do in cellars, we made all speed into the dugout shaft. At 5:15 a.m. the fire increased to an incredible violence. Our dugout rocked and trembled like a ship on a stormy sea. All round resounded the rending of masonry and the crash of collapsing houses. At 7 a.m. I received a message by light signal addressed to the 2nd Battalion. Brigade requires immediate report on the situation. After an hour, a dispatch carrier brought back the news. Enemy taken Alu and Alu Park. Ordered 8th Company to counterattack. No news so far. Rochol, Captain. This was the only message that my tremendous apparatus of transmission had to deal with during all 3 weeks of my time in Fresnoy, though certainly it was a very important one. And now that my activity was of the utmost value, the artillery fire had put nearly the whole organization out of action. Such were the results of over-centralization. This surprising information explained why we had heard rifle bullets fired at no very great range, clattering against the walls of the houses. We had scarcely realized the great losses suffered by the regiment when the shelling was renewed with increasing fury. My batman was standing, the last of all, on the top step of the dugout stairs when a crash like thunder announced that the English had at last succeeded in knocking in our cellar. The trusty Knieger got a good squared building stone on the back, but was not hurt. Above, everything was shot to blazes. Daylight came to us past two bicycles squeezed into the dugout entrance. We made ourselves as small as we could on the lowest step, while heavy explosions and the din of falling masonry convinced us of the insecurity of our refuge. By a miracle, the telephone was still working, so I explained the plight we were in to my chief at the division, and received orders to withdraw with my men into the dressing station dugout close by. After packing up what it was most essential to take with us, we set about leaving the dugout by the second and only remaining exit. In spite of my peremptory orders, backed up by unequivocal threats, the telephone staff, which was not much used to war, hesitated so long to venture out of the protection of the dugout into the shell fire that this exit, too, was smashed in with a crash by a heavy shell. Luckily, no one was hit. Only our little dog howled miserably, and from that moment was never seen again. We now pushed aside the bicycles that barred the way out through the cellar, and, creeping on all fours over the heaps of debris, got into the open through a narrow crack in the wall. We did not pause to observe the incredible change that these few hours had produced in the village, but ran out of it as fast as we could. The last of us had scarcely left the yard gates when the house got another tremendous hit. A compact belt of fire covered the area between the edge of the village and the dressing station dugout. Light and heavy shells with direct and delay action fuses, duds, empty cases, and shrapnel combined to produce a nightmare of acoustic and optical effects. Through it, passing to right and left of the witch's cauldron seething in the village, the reserves were marching up. In Frenoy, the shells were sending up the earth in fountains as high as church towers. Each seemed bent on outdoing its predecessor. As though by magic, one house after another was sucked into the earth. Walls collapsed, gables fell, and bare rafters were flung through the air to mow the roofs of neighboring houses. Clouds of splinters danced above whitish swaths of vapor. Eye and ear hung as though entranced upon this dance of destruction. We spent 2 days in a painfully confined space in the dressing station dugout, for besides my men there were the staffs of 2 battalions, 2 relief detachments, and the indispensable corps troops. Naturally, the constant coming and going in front of the entrances was observed by the enemy. Soon the range was got to a yard, and at intervals of a minute shells fell on the track outside, and there were casualties all the time. Indeed, the shouts for stretcher-bearers never ceased. I lost 4 bicycles which we had left outside owing to this disagreeable bombardment. They were scattered to the 4 winds in various states of contortion. Stark and still and wrapped in a ground sheet, Lieutenant Lemire, the commander of the 8th Company, lay at the entrance, his large horn spectacles still on his nose. His men had brought him there. He was shot in the mouth. His younger brother was killed a few months later in exactly the same way. On the 30th of April, I handed over to my successor of the 25th Regiment, by whom we were relieved. We made our way to Flers, the rendezvous of the 1st Battalion. Leaving the much-shelled lime kilns, Chez Bonton, on our left, we went quickly on through the afternoon sunshine along the path to Beaumont. Our eyes rejoiced again in the beauty of the earth. We drew in the intoxicating breath of spring, thankful to have escaped the intolerably crowded confinement of the dugout. With the thunder of the guns in our rear, my sympathies were with the poet. Surely the day that God has given has better uses than to kill. In Flers, I found the quarters allotted me in the possession of some staff sergeant majors, who, under the pretext that they had to keep the room for a certain Baron von X, refused to give it up to me. They failed, however, to reckon with the overstrained nerves of a worn-out front-line soldier. I told my men to smash in the door, and after a brief hand-to-hand engagement under the eyes of the owner of the house, who, much alarmed, hastened on to the scene in his dressing gown, we sent the gentleman flying down the stairs. My batman carried politeness to such lengths that he threw their trench boots after them. After this assault, I took possession of the warm bed, surrendering half of it to my friend Kius, who was wandering round without a billet. Sleeping in a bed after so long a time did us so much good that we woke next morning in all our pristine vigour. As the 1st Battalion had come off the lightest in the casualties of the recent days of fighting, we were in excellent trim as we marched to Douai Station. From there we went by train to the junction of Bousigny. We were to have some days' rest in Serine, a village in the neighbourhood. The population was friendly, and we had good quarters. On the very first evening the sounds of happy foregathering were to be heard from many of the houses. These drink-offerings on the morrow of well-fought fights count among an old soldier's happiest memories. And though 10 out of 12 had fallen, still the last 2, as sure as death, were to be found on the first evening of rest over the bottle, drinking a silent health to their dead companions, talking and laughing over all they had been through. For dangers past, an old soldier's laugh. For those to come, a full glass, though death and the devil grin there, as long as the wine was good. Such has ever been the custom of war. It was the officers' mess, more than all, that made me appreciate this. It was here, among the spirits of the undaunted dead, that the will to conquer was concentrated and made visible in the features of each weather-beaten face. There was an element of work here that the very horror of the war underlined and even spiritualized, an element one seldom found among the men with whom one lay in the shell holes, sporting joy in danger and a chivalrous impulse to see things out. And to say the least of it, I have never in this much-reviled circle heard one faint-hearted word. My batman came next morning and read me the orders. From these it appeared that I was to take command of the 4th Company. It was in this company, in the autumn of 1914, that Hermann Lerns, the Lower Saxon poet, fell. Against Indians. On the 6th of May, 1917, we were once more on the march to the now familiar Brancourt, and on the following day we went through Montbrien, Ramecourt, and Joncourt into the Siegfried Line, which we had left just a month before. The first evening was stormy. Heavy rain pattered down without ceasing onto the flooded ground. Soon, however, a succession of bright, warm days reconciled us to our new station. I enjoyed the wonderful country undisturbed by the white puffs of shrapnel and the leaping cones of the shell bursts. Indeed, I scarcely noticed them. In those years of increased activity, the signs of an offensive were as much a part of the spring as primroses and opening buds. Our lines formed a crescent in front of the Saint-Quentin Canal. Behind us was the famous Siegfried Line. I never could tell why we had to occupy the narrow, unfinished trenches in the chalk when behind us lay this magnificent line. The front line wound through an idyllic meadowland, shadowed by small groups of trees and beautified now by the tender colours of spring. We could move about with impunity behind and in front of the trench, for our front was protected by a belt of outposts pushed forward to a depth of a kilometre. These posts were a thorn in the enemy's side, and not a night went by for many weeks that he did not try to dislodge them, either by cunning or force. Our first spell in the line was, however, passed in welcome quiet. The weather was so fine that the men slept out on the grass. On the 14th of May we were relieved by the 8th Company, and leaving the burning Saint Quentin on our right, proceeded to our resting place, Mont Brahai, a large village that so far had suffered very little from the war, and therefore had very comfortable quarters to offer. On the 20th, as company in reserve, we occupied the Siegfried Line. The weather was gorgeous, and day after day we sat in the numerous arbors built in the side of the trench, or bathed in the canal, or boated on it. The objection to occupying a trench otherwise so ideal lies in the frequent visits from superior officers, a pleasure very little esteemed in the line. In any case, my left wing had no cause to complain of being too safe. It extended nearly to the village of Bellinglis, already seriously nibbled at, and on the very first day one of my men got a shrapnel bullet wound in the right buttock. When I hastened to the scene of the disaster, he was seated in great content on his left side, awaiting the stretcher-bearers, and filling in the time with an enormous slice of bread and jam. On the 25th of May, we relieved the 12th Company in Rekival Farm. This farm, formerly a large estate, was occupied in turns by each of the four companies in the line. There were three machine-gun positions at different points in our rear, and these had to be manned by sections in rotation. The strong points distributed behind the line, and covering each other like squares on a chessboard, were the first experiment in an elastic scheme of defense. The rest of the men were sent forward on working parties every night. The farm lay 1,500 meters at most behind the front line. Nevertheless, the buildings, surrounded by a well-timbered park, were still entirely intact. As there were deep dugouts under construction, there were plenty of men there. The red maytree avenues in the park and the charm of the surroundings gave our life there something of the cheerful enjoyment which the Frenchman means by his vie de champagne, in spite of the nearness to the front. A pair of swallows had nested in my bedroom. Before it was light, they started on the noisy business of feeding their brood. In the evenings I took my stick from the corner and wandered along the narrow paths that went up and down through the hilly country. The neglected fields were scented with wildflowers. Here and there single trees stood by the wayside. In peacetime the laborers must have rested beneath them. They had an air of enchantment, standing alone in the solitude, covered with blossom, white or pink or red. It seemed that the war had thrown a heroic and melancholy light over the landscape, and without disturbing its loveliness, added a ray to its brightness and a strength to its spell. It is easier to go into the battle in the midst of such beauties of nature than when surrounded by a dead and cold winter landscape. Somehow it comes to one quite simply that one's existence is part of an eternal circuit, and that the death of a single individual is no such great matter. On the 30th of May this idyll came to an end as far as I was concerned, for the command of the 4th Company was taken over again by Lieutenant Vogely, who had come out of hospital. I rejoined my old 2nd Company, now under the command of a cavalry lieutenant, in the line. Our front, extending from the Roman road to the so-called artillery trench, was held by 2 platoons. The 3rd, with company headquarters, was about 200 meters to the rear, behind a small hill. There was a little wooden hut there, too, that I used to occupy with Lieutenant Kius, peacefully relying upon the poor shooting of the English artillery. One side of it was built into the slope of a little hill facing the enemy. The three others trustingly offered themselves as a mark. Every day, when the morning's greetings came hurtling across, the following dialogue might be heard between the occupants of the upper and lower bunks. "That you, Ernst?" "Hmm? They're shooting, aren't they?" "Well, let's lie where we are a little longer. I think those were the last ones." After a quarter of an hour. "That you, Oscar?" "Yes. They're not going to stop today. I think that was a shrapnel bullet that came through the wall just now. We'd better get up. That artillery observer fellow cleared out long ago." We had always optimistically taken off our boots. By the time we were ready, the shooting had generally left off, and we could seat ourselves happily at the absurdly small table and drink coffee that the heat had turned sour, and light our morning cigars. In the afternoon, in scorn of the English artillery, we used to have sunbaths on a ground sheet in front of the dorm. Our cabin was extremely entertaining in other respects, too. When one lay in sweet idleness on the wire mattress, gigantic earthworms hung pendulum-wise from the earth wall, and shot into their holes with inconceivable rapidity at the least touch. A peevish mole sniffed about from his tunnel and added much to the enlivenment of our prolonged siesta. On the 12th of June I had to occupy the outpost on the company front with 20 men. It was late when we left the trench and went in the warm evening air by the footpath winding over the undulating ground. Dusk was so far advanced that the red poppies in the untilled fields blended with the vivid green grass to an extraordinarily rich tone. We strolled silently along over the carpet of flowers. Each man was busy with his own thoughts. Our rifles hung from our shoulders, and in 20 minutes we arrived at our destination. In whispers the post was taken over. Silently guards were mounted. Then the man we relieved disappeared into the darkness. The outpost rested upon a short, steep hill. In the rear, a wild and tangled wood melted into the night. It was separated from our steep bank by about 100 meters of meadow ground. In front and to our right rose 2 hills over which ran the English lines. There was a ruin on one with the promising name Ascension Farm. A sunken road ran between these hills to the enemy. And now, just as my posts had gone out, appeared Sergeant Major Hackman with a few men of the 7th Company, just about to go on patrol. I attached myself to them as camp follower, though I had no business to leave my post. Using a method of advance invented by myself, we crossed 2 entanglements that barred our way and got over the crest of the hill without, to our surprise, having run into a single outpost. We could now hear English working parties to right and to left of us. It was clear to me, after the event, that the enemy had withdrawn his own post so as not to involve them in the fire which, as I shall shortly explain, he was about to open on ours. My method of advance, mentioned just now, consisted in this, that over ground in which we might at any moment run up against the enemy, each member of the patrol crept forward in turn. In this way, only one man at a time exposed himself to the risk of being shot from an ambush, while the rest, in a body behind, lay in readiness to attack. Naturally, I took care to take my turn as leader, although my mere presence with the patrol was bad enough in itself. An officer in the front line has often to put himself technically in the wrong from considerations of a personal kind. We stalked several working parties that, unfortunately, were separated from us by dense entanglements. The somewhat eccentric Sergeant Major suggested giving himself up as a deserter, and holding the enemy in parley until we had surrounded the first post. This plan was turned down after a brief discussion, and we crept back, disappointed, to the outpost. There I sat down on the edge of the steep bank on my cloak, and, lighting a pipe as cautiously as possible, I gave rein to my thoughts. In the midst of the most beautiful castle in the air, I was suddenly alarmed by a peculiar rustling in the wood and the meadow. In the face of the enemy, the senses are always on the lookout, and it is remarkable that, in such moments, quite ordinary sounds can give one the instant conviction something is up. At the same instant, the nearest post came up to me. "Sir, there are 70 Englishmen advancing to the edge of the wood." I was rather surprised by the numerical precision, but for the sake of prudence I hid myself with the 4 men nearest me on the edge of the bank in the long grass, in order to observe how matters developed. After a few seconds I saw a body of men gliding over the meadow. While the men covered them with their rifles, I called out softly, "Who goes there?" It was Teilengerdes, an NCO, an old veteran of the 2nd Company who was trying to collect his agitated section. I at once got them all in hand and formed them in line with one flank on the wood and the other on the bank. In a moment bayonets were fixed. When I was giving them directions and told a man who hung back to dress up with the rest, "I am a stretcher-bearer," was the answer. The fellow had his drill well in his head. Comforted by this triumph of Prussian discipline, I gave the word to advance. While we were crossing the strip of meadow, a hail of shrapnel and a wild clatter of machine-gun fire began from the English side. We broke against our wills into a double so as to reach the cover of the shoulder of the hill that lay to our front. Suddenly, a dark shadow rose in front of me. I seized a bomb and threw it. To my horror, I saw in the flash of the explosions that it was the NCO, Tylengerdes, who had got in front unobserved and had just been tripped up by a wire. Fortunately, he was not hurt. At the same time, we heard the sharper explosions of English bombs not far off, and the shrapnel fire increased to an unpleasant intensity. My firing line broke and disappeared in the direction of the steep bank, which was under heavy fire. I, with Tylengerdes and three more of the right sort, stood my ground. Suddenly, one of them rushed up to me. The English! Like a vision engraved for 1 second on my eyes, I saw a double row of kneeling figures at that moment, getting up and advancing over the meadow, which was lit up only by an occasional flash. I could clearly distinguish the figure of an officer on the right flank. Friend and foe were as though paralyzed by this abrupt and unexpected encounter. Then we did the one thing left us to do, turned and made off before the enemy recovered sufficiently to fire a shot. We jumped up and ran back to the bank. Though I tripped and fell over a treacherous wire stretched through the tall grass, I got back without further misadventure. The men were there, but they were in a state of great agitation, and it cost me all my energy to get them into line, even elbow to elbow. I have always observed that the ordinary man whose sole preoccupation is his own danger is surprised by what seems to him an undivided attention to the matter in hand on the part of the officer in command, who, among 1,001 unnerving incidents of battle, yet keeps his eye fixed upon the execution of his duty. This surprise makes an officer excel himself, and spurs him on to always greater achievements. In this way, officers and men call out energies in each other which would otherwise lie dormant. Indeed, the moral factor is everything. The enemy fire ceased of a sudden, and at the same time crackling and rustling sounds were heard in the undergrowth of the wood. "Halt! Who goes there? Password!" We kept on calling out for a good 5 minutes, and even shouted the old battle cry of the 1st Battalion, "Lutje Lager!" an expression signifying schnapps and beer, known to every Hanoverian. Only a strange and incomprehensible shout came in reply. At last I took the responsibility on myself and gave the order to fire, though some of the men asserted that they had heard German words. A fire of 20 rifles swept the wood. Bolts rattled, and soon the cry we had heard changed to moans. This gave me a passing twinge of uncertainty. However, there were yellow flashes here and there in our direction, though they soon died away. One of the men was hit in the shoulder, and the stretcher-bearers bound him up. "Cease fire!" Slowly the command took effect, and the firing ceased. The men had quite recovered their nerve. Once more there were calls for the password, and on my side the persuasive summons, "Come here, you are prisoners, hands up!" Thereupon there were confused cries from the other side, which were interrupted by the men as "Rache, Rache," "Revenge, revenge." A single figure detached itself from the border of the wood and came towards us. One of the men was idiot enough to shout "Password!" at him, at which he stopped and turned round. "Shoot him dead!" There were 12 shots, and he sank in a heap beneath the tall grass. This little episode gave us a feeling of satisfaction. Once more confused cries rang out from the edge of the wood. It seemed that the attacking party were encouraging each other to advance on their mysterious enemy. In the utmost excitement, we kept our eyes fixed on the dark strip of ground. It was beginning to dawn, and a light mist rose from the meadowland. Then a row of shadows rose out of the darkness. 5, 10, 15, a whole lot of them. Trembling fingers released the safety catches. They were 50 meters from us. 30, 15, fire! For a minute the rifles rattled out. Sparks showered up whenever the storm of bullets encountered weapons or steel helmets. Suddenly there was a shout, "Look out on the left!" Coming quickly on, a party of the enemy was attacking us on the left flank. At the head of it was a giant with outstretched revolver, swinging a white bludgeon. "Left section, left front!" The men whipped round and received the new arrivals standing. Some of them, and among them their leader, fell at the first hurried shots. The rest vanished as swiftly as they had come. Now was the moment to attack in turn. With fixed bayonets and a rousing hurrah, we stormed the wood. We threw a volley of bombs into the tangled undergrowth, and in a moment were once more in undisturbed possession of our outpost, without having encountered the pliant enemy. We assembled in a cornfield and looked at each other. Our faces had an after-the-night-before look, and a lark that rose into the sky and began its trills was an added exasperation. We were in much the same mood as when, after a night of play, the cards are flung onto the table and the windows thrown open to let the cool morning air blow away the hanging cloud of cigar smoke. While we handed round the water bottles and lit cigars, we heard the enemy retreating along the sunken road and the cries of the wounded they carried with them. I decided to survey the field of battle. Strange sounds and cries of pain came from the meadow where we had routed the enemy with our rifle fire. We found a number of dead in the long grass and three wounded who begged for mercy. They were convinced we would massacre them. When I asked, "Quelle nation?" one of them answered, "Pauvre Rajput." They were Indians who had come far over the sea to run their heads against the Hanover Fusiliers in this godforsaken corner of the earth. Their fine bodies were in evil plight. At that short range, infantry fire has an almost explosive effect. Many had been hit for the second time when they had fallen, so that the track of the bullet passed along the whole length of their bodies. Not one had been hit less than twice. We took the wounded up and carried them to our trench. They cried out as if they were being stuck with spears, till the men had to stop their mouths and threaten them with their fists, and at this they seemed to be comforted in their anguish. One of them died while he was being carried in. He was taken on all the same, as there was a prize on the head of every prisoner, dead or alive. The two others strove to win our indulgence by shouting out all the time, "Anglais pas bon! The English are no good!" Why these people spoke French I have never quite made out. The company had heard the sounds of fighting and had had a heavy barrage put down on them. They welcomed us back to the trench in jubilation and with astonishment at our booty. I retired to our cabin with Kius and half a dozen more whom he quickly enrolled, and was entertained in honor of the occasion with poached eggs. Our achievement received the notice it deserved and was mentioned in divisional orders with praise. With 20 men we had beaten back a detachment many times our number, though they had taken us in the rear, and though our orders were to withdraw if attacked in force. Such successes can, of course, only be won by troops whose discipline and morale are of the first order. Of myself, I could say with satisfaction that my command of the situation and my personal influence with my men had prepared a severe disappointment and an early grave for the officer who led the attack. We, too, had matched our wits in the same way as is customary in field exercises in training, except that we had not used dummy cartridges. If these lines are read by anyone belonging to the 1st Haryana Lancers, I wish to express to him in this place my respect for a body of men who could claim as their commander such a one as he whom I had the honor to fight. What does Nietzsche say of fighting men? You must have as enemies only those whom you hate, but not those whom you despise. You must be proud of your enemy, and then the enemy's success is your success also. The next evening I had orders again to occupy the outpost. It was impossible to occupy it by day, as it was in full view of the enemy. Kius and I, with 50 men, took each a side of the wood and met at the steep bank. There was nothing to be seen or heard of the enemy except that there was a shout and a very light and a shot from the sunken road which Sergeant Major Hackman and I had reconnoitred. We marked this unwary individual down for our next expedition. At the spot where we had beaten off the flank attack the night before were lying three dead. Two of them were Indians, and one a white officer with two gold stars on his shoulder straps, a lieutenant, therefore. He had been shot in the eye. The bullet went out through the opposite temple and had smashed the rim of his steel helmet, which is now among my collection of sinister trophies. His right hand still grasped the club, stained with his own blood. His left, a large Colt six-shooter. There were only two live cartridges left in the magazine. The men plundered the fallen. I have always hated this sight. All the same, I did not interfere. What they took was otherwise doomed to waste away, and aesthetic or moral considerations seemed to me to be out of place in this dark meadow ground over which all the callous relentlessness of war still brooded. During the following days, several more dead bodies were found in the undergrowth of the wood. This showed how heavy the enemy's losses had been, and made the outpost a rather unpleasant place to be in. As I was working my way alone through a thicket, I heard a peculiar hissing and murmuring sound. I went nearer and came upon two corpses in which the heat had awakened a ghastly life. On the 18th of June, the outpost was again attacked. This time the affair did not go off so well. The men broke and could not be rallied again. One, an NCO, Erdolt, jumped straight off the bank in the confusion. He rolled down and landed at the bottom among a party of Indians in ambush. He threw bombs, but was soon caught by the throat by an Indian officer and scourged in the face with a wire whip. His watch was taken from him, and he was pushed and thumped and marched off by his captors. However, he managed to escape when the Indians threw themselves down on account of our machine-gun fire. After long wanderings behind the enemy's front, he regained our lines, with thick weals across his face. On the evening of the 18th of June, I went on patrol with Little Schultz, 10 men and a light machine gun. We set out from the outpost, now becoming by degrees somewhat oppressive, with the aim of paying the post that had lately made itself so obvious in the sunken road the honor of a visit. Schultz went with his party to the right of the sunken road, I to the left, with the understanding that if either party were fired on, the other should run to its help. We worked our way forward on hands and knees through grass and thickets of broom, pausing now and then to listen. Suddenly came the sharp rattle of a rifle bolt. We sank into the ground. Every old hand knows the series of feelings that occupied the next seconds. For the moment, one has lost the initiative and must wait and see what the enemy does next. A shot broke the oppressive stillness. I lay behind a broom bush and waited. On my right, someone threw bombs into the sunken road. At once a whole line of fire flashed out in front of us. The sickening sharpness of the report showed that the fire came from only a few yards ahead of us, and seeing that we had stumbled into too hot a corner, I gave the word to run for it. We all sprang up and sprinted for all we were worth, while rifle fire was opened on us from our left as well. I gave up all hope of a safe return when I heard this unholy clatter. Unconsciously, I was in constant expectation of being hit, and death was out hunting. Somewhere near us, a detachment advanced to the attack with a shrill hurrah. Little Schultz confessed to me afterwards that he imagined a lean Indian behind him wielding a knife and already clutching him tight by the neck. I tumbled once and brought down the NCO Thailengadders over on top of me. I lost my steel helmet, revolver, and bombs. Anything to get on. At last we reached the protecting bank and tore down it. Lieutenant Schultz reached it at the same time with his men. He announced, quite out of breath, that anyway he had paid out the cheeky post with bombs. Just after, two men came in carrying Fusilier F, who was wounded in both legs. All the rest were unwounded. The worst misfortune was that the man who had carried the machine gun, a recruit, had fallen over the wounded man and left the thing behind. While we were holding a brief council of war and planning a second expedition, the artillery began firing. I was reminded very precisely of the night of the 12th, for this time, too, there was a hopeless stampede. I found myself alone on the bank with the wounded man, who, dragging himself forward by both his hands, implored me piteously not to leave him alone. "Don't leave me, sir." I had to, little as I liked it, in order to take my part in putting the outpost in fighting trim. I got the man together in a row of shallow firing positions on the edge of the wood, but I confess I was thankful when the day dawned without further incident. On such occasions, I was always surprised and touched by the trusting reliance of the men on the ability of the officer to cope with the situation. "Where shall we go, sir?" "Help, sir, I'm wounded. Where's the officer?" To be in command at such moments and to have a clear head is its own supreme reward, just as cowardice is its own punishment. I have always pitied the coward in whom battle arouses a series of hellish tortures, while the spirit of the brave man merely rises the higher to meet a chain of exciting experiences. The next night found us at the same spot. Our object was to recover our machine gun. However, a succession of suspicious noises as we crept on warned us that once more there must be a strong detachment on the watch for us. It was decided, therefore, in accordance with a point of honor, which, like many others in the war, made us inwardly curse, to recover the lost weapon by force. At 12 midnight, after 3 minutes' artillery preparation, we were to attack the enemy posts and look for the gun. I put the best face I could on the sorry business, and in the afternoon I shot some ranging shots with some of the batteries. At 11 at night I was once more with Schultz, my companion in misfortune, on the uncanny bit of ground where I had already passed so many exciting moments. The smell of corruption was scarcely endurable in the sultry air. We sprinkled the bodies with quicklime that we had brought with us in sacks. The covering of white shone out like grave clothes in the darkness. The enterprise opened with our own machine-gun fire whistling between our legs and pattering against the bank. On this account Schultz and I had a violent altercation, for he himself had given the machine-gunners their range. We were reconciled, however, when Schultz discovered me behind a bush in close confabulation with a bottle of Burgundy that I had brought with me to invigorate me for the precarious adventure and to calm my nerves, which had been on the stretch for 9 days past. The first shell came along to the minute and landed 50 meters behind us. Before we could express our surprise at this extraordinary shooting, a second was planted close behind us on the bank and showered us with earth. It was not for me even to emit a curse, for I had myself given the range for the guns. After this cheerful opening, we advanced more as a matter of honor than with any great hopes of success. Luckily, the enemy posts had apparently retired. Otherwise, we might have had a very unpleasant reception. Unfortunately, we did not find the machine gun, nor did we search for it very long. On the way back, Schultz and I once more told each other what we really thought. I about the way he had directed his machine-gun fire, and he about the shooting of the guns. I had tested the range so accurately that the affair seemed incomprehensible. Later, I learned that guns always shoot short at night, and that I ought to have added a few 100 meters when I gave the range. Then we sat down to the most important part of the business, the report. We did so well that everyone was delighted. These skirmishings came to an end the next day, for we were relieved by another division. We went back to Montbrehein for a time, and marched from there to Cambrai, where we spent nearly the whole of July. The outpost was finally lost on the night following our relief. Longemarck. Cambrai is a quiet, sleepy little town whose name calls up many historical associations. The narrow, old-world streets twist about round the mighty town hall, the weathered gates and the many churches. Ponderous towers rear themselves from a maze of gables. Broad avenues lead to the park, which is adorned by a monument to the aviator Blériot. The inhabitants are peaceful, friendly folk who lead a comfortable bourgeois life in the large houses, which are simple to look at but richly furnished. Many retired people settle here. The town is rightly called La Ville de Millionnaire, for there were over 40 millionaires there just before the war. The war broke its enchanted sleep with brutal suddenness and turned it into a focus of mighty battles. A new life hurried and rattled over its unevenly paved streets and clattered against the little windows where anxious faces were on the watch. Foreigners drank the treasured cellars dry, flung themselves on the great mahogany beds, and upset the contemplative civilians with something fresh every day. Now, in their changed surroundings, they could do no more than collect at corners or in doorways and hold whispered consultations over the latest fairy tales of an eyewitness and the most certain news of the final and speedy victory of their fellow countrymen. The men lived in barracks and the officers in the Rue de Ligny. While we were there, this street had the appearance of a student's quarter. Conversation carried on from one window to another, nightly sing-songs, and little romantic adventures were the order of the day. We went every morning for training to the great square near the village of Fontaine, which was later to become famous. My job was a very interesting one, for Colonel von Oppen had entrusted me with the training of the storm troops. My billet was extremely comfortable. It was in the house of a jeweler named Blanco Boulon, and he and his wife were both very friendly. They seldom allowed my midday meal to pass without sending me up something good from their own table. At night we drank tea together, played cards, and talked. One of the questions we most often discussed, naturally enough, was the very difficult one: why there had to be wars. On these occasions, Monsieur Planco used to tell stories of the citizens of Cambrai, who are never too busy for a joke. In peacetime, these stories had sent streets, wine shops, and market into roars of laughter, and they reminded me very forcibly of Tillier's wonderful Uncle Benjamin. A wicked fellow once sent to all the hunchbacks of the district, requesting them to call on a certain solicitor with reference to an important inheritance. At the appointed hour, he and some of his friends watched from the window of the opposite house and enjoyed the delightful comedy. 17 outraged and weeping hobgoblins storming the office of the unfortunate lawyer. There was the story, too, of an old spinster who lived opposite, and who was distinguished by a long and slender neck, strangely bent to one side. 20 years before, she had been notoriously eager to marry. 6 young fellows presented themselves, and to each she gladly gave the permission to speak to her parents. The next Sunday, a capacious coach drove up in which sat the 6 young men, each with a bouquet in his hand. In terror, she locked the door and hid herself, and the suitors delighted the neighborhood by playing the fool in the street. Again, a notorious young Cambrisian went to the market and asked a peasant's wife, pointing to a soft, round, and appetizing cheese covered with green mold, "What is the price of this cheese?" 20 sous, sir." He paid her the 20 sous. "So the cheese is now mine?" "To be sure, sir." "And can I do what I like with it?" "Well, of course." Smack, he threw the cheese in her face and fled. On the 25th of July, we left the dear little town and entrained for Flanders. We had read in the papers that an artillery duel was raging there such as the world had never seen. We detrained in Staten to the distant thunder of guns, and marched through the unfamiliar landscape to our camp. On either side of the dead straight road were green and fruitful fields, raised up in plots like flower beds, and luscious, well-watered meadows surrounded by hedges. There were clean farmhouses scattered here and there, with low thatched or tiled roofs, and on the walls bundles of tobacco plants hung out to dry. The country folk on the roads were of German type, and their rough speech had a pleasant, homely sound. We spent the afternoon in the farm gardens to avoid being seen from the air. Now and then the shells of heavy naval guns could be heard rushing hoarsely overhead from far back, and then exploding not far from us. A number of men of the 91st Regiment who were bathing in one of the numerous little streams were killed. Towards evening I had to go with an advanced detachment to the front line to prepare for the relief, and we went through Hutholst Forest and the village of Kirkuit to the reserve battalion. On the way we had to break step once or twice on account of some heavy shells. In the darkness I heard the voice of a recruit. "The officer never lies down. He knows what he is about," an older soldier informed him. "Wait till a proper one comes, and he'll be the first to lie down." The man had noticed the principle I always followed. "Only take cover when it is necessary, and then do it quickly." It is true that only the experienced can judge of the necessity and feel the end of the shell's trajectory before the recruit has even recognized the light warning whisper in the air. Our guides, who did not seem to be quite sure of themselves, took us along an endless box trench. Such is the name for trenches that are not dug in the ground, because the water would stand in them at once, but built up above its level with sandbags and fascines. Then we went along the side of a terribly disheveled wood, from which a few days before, according to our guides, a regimental staff had been driven by the small matter of 1,000 24-centimeter shells. Things seemed to be done on a large scale here, I thought to myself. After we had wandered backwards and forwards through thick undergrowth, we came to a halt in a piece of ground overgrown with weeds and fringed by a marshy swamp in whose black pools the moonlight was reflected. Our guide had abandoned us, and all the while shells were falling somewhere and slinging up the mud that splashed back again into the water. At last the miserable guide returned to receive the full volley of our wrath and to announce that he had found the way. Nevertheless, he again led us astray till we came at last to a dressing station over which shrapnel shells were bursting in couples at short and regular intervals. The bullets and empty cases rattled through the branches. The M.O. on duty gave us a sensible fellow who took us on to the Meuseburg, the headquarters of the reserve line. From there I went straight on to the company of the 225th Regiment that our second company was to relieve. It took me a long search in the shell-pitted country before I found a few ruinous houses that were fortified inside by reinforced concrete. One had been smashed in the day before by a shell, and the occupants squashed like mice beneath the falling roof-plate. I spent the rest of the night in the company commander's overcrowded concrete blockhouse. He was an honest front-line swine who, with his orderlies, was passing the time over a bottle of schnapps and a good chunk of pork, with frequent intervals during which he listened to the steadily increasing shell fire and shook his head. Then he would fall to bemoaning the good old days on the Russian front and cursing the way his regiment had been pumped out. At last I fell asleep. My sleep was heavy and oppressed. The H.E. shells falling all round the house in the pitchy darkness evoked a sense of indescribable loneliness and forlornness from the murdered landscape. Involuntarily I nestled up to a man who shared the same bunk. Once I was scared by a heavy thump. My men made a light and looked to see if the wall had been penetrated. It was found that a light shell had exploded against the outer wall. I spent the next afternoon with the commanding officer of the battalion at the Meuseburg, as there were still some important points on which I had to be informed. All the time, 15-centimeter shells were falling round headquarters, while the captain, with his adjutant and the orderly officer, played an endless game of scat over a soda-water bottle full of raw spirits. Sometimes he put his cards down to send off a report, or to discuss very seriously whether our concrete shelter was bomb-proof. We convinced him, in spite of the warmth with which he argued the contrary, the wish being clearly the father to the thought, that we were not fitted to sustain a direct hit from the air. In the evening the customary artillery fire rose to frantic intensity, and in the front line there was an unceasing display of colored lights. Dust-covered dispatch carriers brought in reports that the enemy was attacking. After weeks of drum fire, the infantry battle had begun. I went back to company headquarters and waited there for the arrival of the second company. It appeared at 4 in the morning during a very lively burst of shell fire. I took command of my platoon at once and led it to a position covered with the fragments of a shell-destroyed house, a spot most unspeakably forlorn in the midst of an immense and dreary waste of shell holes. At 6 in the morning the Flanders mist lifted and gave us a glimpse of our ghastly surroundings. At once a swarm of low-flying enemy machines appeared, scrutinizing the battered ground and sounding sirens. Any scattered detachments of infantry that were above ground instantly endeavored to hide themselves in shell holes. Half an hour later, a terrific artillery fire set in. It raged round our refuge like a typhoon-scourged sea round an island. The hail of shells thickened to a throbbing wall of fire. We crouched together, expecting each second the crashing hit that would sweep us up with our concrete blocks and make our position indistinguishable from the desert of craters all round. The whole day passed in bursts of heavy shell fire like this, with pauses during which we prepared ourselves for the next bout. In the evening an exhausted orderly turned up and handed me an order. From this I learned that the 1st, 3rd, and 4th companies were to counter-attack at 10:30, and that the 2nd company, after being relieved, was to swarm into the front line. In order to get a little strength to face the hours ahead, I lay down, never dreaming that my brother Fritz, whom I supposed to be still in Hanover, was in a section of the 3rd company, and passing close to my hut in a hurricane of fire on his way to the attack. My sleep was disturbed for a long while by the pitiful cries of a wounded man whom 2 Saxons had brought in. They had lost their way and were utterly done up and had fallen asleep. When they woke in the morning their comrade was dead. They carried him to the nearest shell hole, and after covering him with a few shovelfuls of earth, they went on their way, leaving one more to be added to the countless lonely and unknown graves of the war. I woke at 11 out of a heavy sleep. I washed in my helmet and sent for orders to the company commander. To my astonishment he had already gone, without letting me or Cius or our platoons know anything of it. This showed the consequence of putting officers of another arm of the service in command of front-line troops, only because of seniority, and though they did not know even how to handle a rifle. Let such fetishes be followed when human lives are not at stake. While I sat cursing on my bunk and considered what to do, an orderly appeared from battalion headquarters with the order to take immediate command of the 8th Company. I learnt that the counter-attack of the 1st Battalion on the previous night had been repulsed with heavy loss, and that what was left had taken up a defensive position in a small wood called Dobschütz Wood, and to right and left of it. The 8th Company had been given the task of swarming into the wood in support. It had, however, run into a barrage in the intervening ground and suffered heavy losses. As the company commander, Lieutenant Bürdigen, was among the fallen, I was to lead the company on in a fresh advance. After I had taken leave of my orphaned platoon, I made my way with the orderly across country. The desolation lay under a rain of shrapnel, and as we went along half-bent, we were checked by a despairing voice. In the distance we could see a figure with bleeding arm stumps raising itself from a shell hole. We pointed to the hut we had just left and hastened on. I found the 8th Company crouching behind a row of concrete positions, an utterly dispirited little mob. Platoon commanders! Three NCOs came forward and declared that a further advance towards Dobschütz Wood was out of the question. It was indeed the fact that the shells were bursting on our front like a wall of fire. Next I had the platoons assembled behind three concrete positions. Each was about 15 to 20 men strong. At this moment the fire lifted and came on to us. The scene was indescribable. At the concrete position on the left, a whole section was blown into the air. The right got a direct hit and buried Lieutenant Budigan, who was still lying there wounded beneath its tons of masonry. We were in a mortar and beaten down by incessant concussions. Faces as white as death stared at one another, and the cries of those who were hit never ceased. It was all the same now whether we stayed where we were, or went on, or back. So I gave the command to follow me and sprang out into the fire. After a few steps I was covered with earth and flung into a shell hole by a shell which fortunately exploded straight upwards. I observed soon after, however, that the fire was not so heavy further on. When I had worked my way forward another 200 meters, I looked about me. There was not a soul in sight. Finally, two men emerged from the clouds of dust and smoke. Then one more. Then another two. With these five men I safely arrived at my goal. I found Lieutenant Sandfuss, commander of the 3rd Company, and little Schultz seated in a half-smashed-up concrete pillbox with three heavy machine guns. I was greeted with a loud hello and a sip of cognac, and then the situation, by no means a pleasant one, was explained to me. The English were close in front of us, and both our flanks were in the air. We cordially agreed that this was a corner too tight for any but old veterans who had grown grey in the smoke of battle. Without a word of warning, Sandfuss asked me if I had heard anything of my brother. My feelings can be imagined when I heard that he had been in yesterday's attack and was missing. A moment later a man came and told me that my brother was lying wounded in a shelter close by, and pointed out to me a desolate blockhouse covered with uprooted trees. I hurried across a clearing which was covered by rifle fire and went in. What a meeting! My brother lay among a crowd of groaning stretcher cases in a place that stank of death. He was in a sad plight. He had been hit by two shrapnel bullets in the attack, one of which had pierced the lung, and the other his right shoulder. Fever shone in his eyes. It was only with difficulty that he could move or speak or breathe. He returned the pressure of my hand, and we began to talk. It was clear to me that I could not leave him there, for at any moment the English might attack, or a shell put an end to the already damaged concrete shelter. It was a brother's duty to get him sent back at once. In spite of Sandfuss, who would not hear of any weakening of our strength, I ordered the five men who had come with me to get my brother back to the Kolumbusai dressing station, and from there to bring back with them men to rescue the other wounded also. We tied him to a ground sheet and stuck a long pole through it, which rested on two of the men's shoulders. I squeezed his hand again, and the sad procession started on its way. From the edge of the wood I watched the swaying load on its way through another wood, among towering shell bursts. As each one struck, I caught myself together, though the place where I was no safer. It is odd that another's danger makes a stronger impression than one's own. This may be explained partly by the confidence in his own luck that everyone has. The belief that nothing can happen to himself makes each man underestimate the danger. It is only in another's case that one sees how overwhelming it is, and how defenseless its victim. After I had skirmished a little from the shell holes on the forward edge of the wood with the English, who were coming on very slowly, I spent the night with my men and the machine-gun section among the ruins of the concrete pillbox. H.E. shells of quite extraordinary ferocity were going up all the time close by us. In the evening I was within an ace of being killed by one of them. The machine gun began rattling off towards morning when some figures approached in the darkness. It was a patrol of the 76th Regiment, come to get into touch with us. One of them was killed. There were many such mistakes during these days, but it was of no use to dwell on them. At 6 in the morning, we